many of the German princes, and especially the Elector of Saxony, sided with the reformer. Luther went into hiding under the protection of the Saxon Elector, and Charles found himself in the presence of the opening rift that was to split Christendom into two contending camps. Close upon these disturbances, and probably connected with them, came a widespread peasants' revolt throughout Germany. This outbreak frightened Luther very effectually. He was shocked by its excesses, and from that time forth the Reformation he advocated ceased to be a Reformation according to the people, and became a Reformation according to the princes. He lost his confidence in that free judgment for which he had stood up so manfully. Meanwhile, Charles realized that his great empire was in very serious danger, both from the west and from the east. On the west of him was his spirited rival, Francis I. To the east was the Turk in Hungary, in alliance with Francis, and clamoring for certain arrears of tribute from the Austrian dominions. Charles had the money and army of Spain at his disposal, but it was extremely difficult to get any effective support in money from Germany. His grandfather had developed a German infantry on the Swiss model, very much upon the lines expounded in Machiavelli's Art of War. But these troops had to be paid, and his imperial subsidies had to be supplemented by unsecured borrowings, which were finally to bring his supporters, the Fuggers, to ruin. On the whole, Charles, in alliance with Henry VIII, was successful against Francis I and the Turk. Their chief battlefield was North Italy. The generalship was dull on both sides. Their advances and retreats depended chiefly on the arrival of reinforcements. The German army invaded France, failed to take Marseille, fell back into Italy, lost Milan, and was besieged in Pavia. Francis I made a long and unsuccessful siege of Pavia, was caught by fresh German forces, defeated, wounded, and taken prisoner. He sent back a message to his queen that all was lost but honour, made a humiliating peace, and broke it as soon as he was liberated, so that even the salvage of honour was but temporary. Henry VIII and the Pope, in obedience to the rules of Machiavellian strategy, now went over to the side of France in order to prevent Charles becoming too powerful. The German troops in Milan, under the Constable of Bourbon, being unpaid, forced rather than followed their commander into a raid upon Rome. They stormed the city and pillaged it in 1527. The Pope took refuge in the castle of San Angelo while the looting and slaughter went on. He bought off the German troops at last by the payment of 400,000 ducats. 10 years of such stupid and confused fighting impoverished all Europe and left the Emperor in possession of Milan. In 1530 he was crowned by the Pope. He was the last German emperor to be crowned by the Pope at Bologna. One thinks of the rather dull-looking blonde face with its long lip and chin, bearing the solemn expression of one who endures a doubtful, though probably honourable, ceremony. Meanwhile, the Turks were making great headway in Hungary. They had defeated and killed the King of Hungary in 1526. They held Budapest, and in 1529, as we've already noted, Suleiman the Magnificent very nearly took Vienna. The emperor was greatly concerned by these advances, and did his utmost to drive back the Turks, but he found the greatest difficulty in getting the German princes to unite even with this formidable enemy upon their very borders. Francis I remained implacable for a time, and there was a new French war. But in 1538 Charles won his rival over to a more friendly attitude by ravaging the south of France. Francis and Charles then formed an alliance against the Turk, but the Protestant princes, the German princes who were resolved to break away from Rome, had formed a league, the Schmalkaldic League, named after the little town of Schmalkalden in Hesse, at which its constitution was arranged. Against the emperor, and in the place of a great campaign to recover Hungary for Christendom, Charles had to turn his mind to the gathering internal struggle in Germany. Of that struggle he saw only the opening war. It was a struggle, a sanguinary, irrational bickering of princes for ascendancy, now flaming into war and destruction, now sinking back to intrigues and diplomacies. It was a snake's sack of Machiavellian policies that was to go on writhing incurably right into the 19th century and to waste and desolate Central Europe again and again. The emperor never seems to have grasped the true forces at work in these gathering troubles. He was, for his time and station, an exceptionally worthy man, and he seems to have taken the religious dissensions that were tearing Europe into warring fragments as genuine theological differences. He gathered diets and councils in futile attempts at reconciliation. Formulae and confessions were tried over. The student of German history must struggle with the details of the religious peace of Nuremberg, the settlement of the Diet of Ratisbon, the interim of Augsburg, and the like. Here we do but mention them as details in the worried life of this culminating emperor. As a matter of fact, hardly one of the multifarious princes and rulers in Europe seems to have been acting in good faith. The widespread religious trouble of the world, the desire of the common people for truth and social righteousness, the spreading knowledge of the time, all those things were merely counters in the imaginations of princely diplomacy. Henry VIII of England, who had begun his career with a book written against heresy, and who had been rewarded by the Pope with the title of Defender of the Faith, being anxious to divorce his first wife in favour of an animated young lady named Anne Boleyn, and wishing also to turn against the emperor in favour of Francis I and to loot the vast wealth of the church in England, joined the company of the Protestant princes in 1530. Sweden, Denmark, and Norway had already gone over to the Protestant side. The German religious war began in 1546, a few months after the death of Martin Luther. We need not trouble about the incidents of the campaign. The Protestant Saxon army was badly beaten at Lockau. And by something very like a breach of faith, Philip of Hesse, the emperor's chief remaining antagonist, was caught and imprisoned, and the Turks were bought off by the payment of an annual tribute. In 1547, to the great relief of the emperor, Francis I died. So, by 1547, Charles got to a kind of settlement and made his last efforts to effect peace where there was no peace. In 1552, all Germany was at war again. Only a precipitate flight from Innsbruck saved Charles from capture, and in 1552, with the Treaty of Passau, came another unstable equilibrium. Charles was now utterly weary of the cares and splendours of empire. He had never had a very sound constitution. He was naturally indolent, and he was suffering greatly from gout. He abdicated. He made over all his sovereign rights in Germany to his brother Ferdinand, and Spain and the Netherlands he resigned to his son Philip. He then retired to a monastery at Juste, among the oak and chestnut forests, in the hills to the north of the Tagus Valley, and there he died in 1558. Much has been written in a sentimental vein of this retirement, this renunciation of the world by this tired, majestic titan, world-weary, seeking in an austere solitude his peace with God. But his retreat was neither solitary nor austere. He had with him nearly 150 attendants. His establishment had all the indulgences without the fatigues of a court, and Philip II was a dutiful son to whom his father's advice was a command. As for his austerities, let Prescott witness. In the almost daily correspondence between Quixada, or Gotstelu, and the Secretary of State at Valladolid, there is scarcely a letter that doesn't turn more or less on the emperor's eating or his illness,